All right. Yesterday, I focused on a major conflict between the Russians and the Aleuts that took place between December 1763 and the fall of 1765, and in which Aleuts were defeated. When the Russian fur hunters first began exploiting the Aleutian area, conflicts were sporadic and local. The conflict of which I was talking yesterday was organized and sustained. It was a war in which Aleuts took a decision to get rid of the intruders, and they lost. I won't have time to go blow by blow what happened afterwards, and I have to skip over tremendous segments of Alaskan history in general and Aleutian history in particular. But in 1799, after the death of Catherine the Great, Emperor Powell granted a monopoly for exploitation of Alaska to the company owned by the heirs of Grigory Shelikhov, who established a base on Kodiak. From that base on Kodiak, Shelikhov's agent, Baranov, extended his dominion to the eastern Aleutians. And if you remember what I said in the first lecture on the Pribilofs, it was under Baranov that the Pribilofs were settled in 1810. In my opinion, and this is my opinion, the Baranov era is probably the darkest era from the point of view of the Alaskan native. The man was totally ruthless, and he believed that the end justified the means. Eventually, this ruthlessness led to his downfall, because between the Imperial Navy and the Orthodox Church clergy, who reported to the Emperor about Baranov's oppression of the native Alaskans, he was removed. He was removed in 1817, departed Alaska in 1818, and died aboard ship en route to Russia. The interesting thing, though, is, as I mentioned before, ruthless he was, but it was a ruthless age. And he was not stupid. In fact, he was very intelligent, and he earned respect even from the people who hated him. I just want to throw out the idea that respect and hatred do not go necessarily hand in hand. You can hate somebody and yet have respect for that person. What I'm driving at is that when the Tlingit chiefs, who fought Baranov tooth and nail for many years, learned that he was being removed by the Navy, more or less in disgrace, turned out to give him a chief sent off in full regalia. They fought, but he was a good enemy. I don't think that the Aleuts would have done the same. After Baranov era, and this is the era I would like to focus on, there was something approaching reform. One thing about this Russian period is that there was no racism. Please remember that the so-called Russians who sailed here, half of them were Siberian Asiatics anyway. So the Alaskan people did not represent something exotic or strange. They were just people. And they fought them, and they defeated them. But, well, they were people. when the Russian American Company instituted changes after Baranov's departure, it was in the direction of establishing a population policy, establishing the principle that if the natives worked for the company, they were employees who were paid a salary. And also, they consciously wanted to build up a population stratum that would have one foot in the Native American camp and the other in the Russian camp. Very early in the game, schools were established more or less spontaneously by interested people. Shelikhov, of course, established a school on Kodiak in 1785, and it was described in 1788 by a Spanish skipper who visited it. And incidentally, what one reads about a place or a person depends on who is writing. The Russian Navy officers arriving in Kodiak wrote, "What a miserable hole." The Spanish skipper arriving from Baja California said, "What a nice, civilized little town." Yeah. And he was much impressed by the fact that there was a school in Kodiak. A school was operating here in Alaska in 1807. And both boys and girls attended this school, and there was no segregation. Aleut boys and girls and the Russian boys and girls all went to the same school here in Alaska. I have no idea who the teachers were. I don't know how successful was this first school. All I know is that there is a list of students from the school available. Ray and Ernst.
Too late to change the 160th anniversary.
That's right. The second point I want to make is that the Russian attitude was that if an Aleut went to school and learned the skills that were necessary to the company in terms of management position, be it a manager of an outpost, be it a skipper of a company ship, a navigator, a director of a shipyard. If the Aleut was capable, ordinary Russians who were not so capable were subordinate to the Aleut. By 1818, we have an Aleut from Unalaska, Andrei Ustyugov, skippering a company ship and dispatched to explore Bering Sea coast from Bristol Bay to the Yukon Delta. Before I go on, I'm substituting here for Father Michael Alexa, who didn't make it. It is his topic I'm covering today. Before I go on and will give you the names and accomplishments of Aleut people during the Russian period, within the Russian-American company establishment and within the Russian imperial establishment, let me talk about the class of people that the Russians labeled Creole. Imperial Russia was a ranked society. Mostly, the rank was hereditary, and was linked to an occupation. They were peasants, townsmen or burghers. They were merchants. They were skilled workmen. Then they were the service gentry, normally called nobility. But it is very misleading because the Russian classes of this sort are in no way comparable to the feudal classes of England or France and the England and French concept of the nobles and commoners. There was a great deal of mobility between classes. And the class was very often assigned by the performance. Let me give you an example. A little boy was born on Kodiak Island very early in the 1800s. His name was Grigory Terentyev. Apparently his father was a Russian, his mother was an Aleut from Kodiak. He went to school. It was recognized that he was very bright, and Baranov sent him to St. Petersburg to be educated. He was trained in management. And he returned to Alaska, and the directors of the Russian-American company were so impressed with his abilities that they appointed him as a manager of Unalaska district. He was going, this young man from Kodiak, of native origin, was going to run Unalaska district, including the Pribilof Islands, including the Shumagansin Peninsula. The governor of Russian-American Company at that time wrote back and said, I can't appoint him to Unalaska as you directed me, because there's a large Russian colony and they will resent taking orders from a Creole or a native. What do you think the directors answered? They said, what's your problem? Stop calling him Creole, call him a Russian. A few years later, this same man was appointed the manager of the Atka district, which was the Russian-American company establishment from Atka to Attu to Commander Islands and to Northern Kurils. He retired on Atka, and the last entry before he migrated in 1874 to Siberia, leaving Atka and leading about 36 or so Aleut families from Alaska to Commander Islands, he is referred in the records as a Russian nobleman. Do you see what I mean? That the class was not rigid. Yakov Netsvetov, the first Aleut to become Orthodox priest, became a Russian nobleman too. He was given automatic, he was given two decorations, the Order of St. Anna and the Order of St. Vladimir. He was a cavalier. That automatically made him a nobleman. It had nothing to do with biological parentage of a person. Do you understand what I'm saying? It is very difficult to make people understand this kind of fluidity in assignments of people to social positions in a country that theoretically had a rigid ranking. Now, I mentioned that the imperial government established a population policy. Movement of from Russia into Alaska was restricted. Russian American company had a right to recruit a limited number of workers who came here for a time and were supposed to leave. because the Russian imperial government, quite consciously from the time of Catherine the Great, developed a population policy that said, we do not want the native population to be overwhelmed by numbers. We are going to establish an educational system and create a Western educated stratum that is native, and they are going to run the place. Records of Russian American company are full of petitions from men who came here, married, established families, their contract is up, they have to go back to Russia. The petition says, what am I going to do? I have my family here, I don't want to go back, may I stay here? Those petitions were not always granted. And when they were not granted, those men took their Alaskan families back home with them. Now, the Russian government, too, cohabitation happens, of course, as Father Michael says, nature takes its course. You put two groups of people in reasonable proximity to each other, they're going to mix. But the Russian government frowned on cohabitation without benefit of clergy and encouraged legal matrimony. The result was that in very short order, there was a substantial number of people living around the Russian settlements of mixed ancestry. And between the Russian American company and the Russian government, they came up with a status. They chose a very unfortunate name. It was a civil status. They used the French term Creole. It was a status or rank equivalent to a burgher or townsman in metropolitan Russia, and it was inherited in the male line. So that if a Creole married a full-blooded native, to use the American term, his children would be Creole. But if a woman of a status Creole married an Aleut, her children would be Aleuts. And the Aleut in the schema of the Russian-American government in this period after 1880 were equivalent to the status of the free peasant, farmer in Russia. What is important here, that in the Russian Empire, those ranks, they had differential duties toward the state and had differential rights. For example, a nobleman or a gentleman could not buy and sell. He couldn't run a bank. When Shelikhov was given the rank of a nobleman, Catherine the Great made an exemption as she issued a special degree permitting him to continue his mercantile activities as a merchant and things like that. It's very complicated. You'll have to come to Fairbanks and take a class from me that runs a semester. But the Creoles here, they were resented by the Russians because many Russians came here under contract. They were just ordinary people, ordinary laborers, and the Creoles had special privileges. They could have free education. They could be sent to Russia to schools which were closed to the Russians of lower ranks. And, for example, in Father Vinyaminov's book, he has some harsh things to say about the Creoles. He says they were conceited, their noses are up in the air, and so on. Many, many Russians of humble origin resented the people here in Alaska who had the Creole status because they had privileges not available to the Russians. And when either Aleuts or Creoles achieved the position of authority, those humble Russians were subordinate to them. For example, in 1818, a Creole named Piotr Klimovsky from Kodiak led an expedition to the Kuskokwim and the Yukon. And there were three Russians in his party subordinate to him. When Ruf Serebrennikov, of Unalaskan origin, he was a navigator, led the exploration party to the Upper Copper River in 1848. He got killed, by the way. His party was mostly Aleuts and one Russian in subordinate position. Ruf Serebrennikov was chosen to lead this party because he was known to be extremely gifted mathematician, in addition to being trained navigator. I have to laugh because Alaska Journal published an account of the killing of Serebrennikov party, and some woman put out a little booklet on it, and they say that Ruf Serebrennikov left a posterity, a blue-eyed blonde boy, genetic impossibility, because by American standards, he was about 6/8 or whatever, or 3/4. Aleut. The educational system established in Alaska, which was open to everybody who wanted it, Aleut, Creole, children of the Russian settlers here, which were very few. Please remember that for the most time, they were about, at the most, 500 Russians in the whole of Alaska. Most of them were in Sitka, St. Paul, Kodiak, and there was about 50 people here in Alaska. The numbers grew to about 800 before the transfer. They brought in a battalion from Siberia so that they could make a good showing at the ceremonies of transfer. Now, if you consider the territory they control, 500 people, that spread awfully thin. Somebody had to run this place. And Aleuts, for the most part, were the middle management people who run the territory of Alaska for the Russian government and the Russian American company. And they were given a different status. For example, I mentioned it before when I talked about the Pribilofs, that Kasyan Shayashnikov of Unalaska in 1827 was appointed manager of the entire Pribilof Island operation, and that he held that position until his death in 1860. In the records, it said he's a Creole, and I always felt, no, he is not of mixed ancestry. The status Creole is a social designation. I found the record. His father was an Aleut, and I don't remember from which village, I believe from Somers Bay. He was assigned the status Creole when he was given a position of responsibility of running the entire Pribilof Island operation. Another gentleman who comes from Unalaska, he was born in Unga, spent his early childhood at Belkovsky, and came to school here in 1825, is a man named Ilarion Archimandritov. I sort of have a hunch that the Archimandritas are still around somewhere. He went to St. Petersburg to the Navy Navigator School. He eventually became a skipper in command of company ships. He mapped Kodiak Island, Prince William Sound Peninsula in the famous Chebinkov Atlas of Alaska. Those maps are signed by Ilarion Archimandritov. He lived a long life. In 1867, he left Alaska and he went to San Francisco, where he joined a radical group clustering around a man named Agapi Honcharenko, who put out a newspaper called Alaska Herald, which attacked the granting of monopoly to Alaska Commercial Company. However, he couldn't stay away, and he came back and became an employee of Russian American Company. There are documents extant that say that the Aleuts of St. George, the Aleuts of St. Paul, and the Aleuts of Unalaska formally asked him to represent their interests and protect the communities against the depredations of the carpetbaggers who flooded Alaska in 1867-1868, and be a spokesman for the Aleut communities before United States government. I don't know where he died. I do know that he collected Aleut artifacts for Imperial Academy of Sciences. I do know that a collection of artifacts that he is in Yale, it says Ilarion Archimandritov's collection at the Yale Peabody Museum at Yale. So that he got around. And he operated at a different level. He eventually sort of blended into the upper strata during the American time. He became a white by the sheer force of personality. I don't have to tell you about Father Yakov Nitsvetov, who served his native Atka from 1828 to 1844, and in 1845 went to the Yukon, where he established the Orthodox mission, built the first Orthodox church. He was an Aleut patriot. First of all, the first thing he did, the kayaks in this place are inferior. He arrived in 1845. In the spring of 1846, he was building Aleut kayaks and Aleut baidaras because he didn't like the Yukon ones. He also opined that the native medicine that is based on the knowledge of plants is vastly inferior to the Aleut one, and he became very well known in the region as a healer. And he remarks in his journals that they bring people to him that the shamans have given up. And he says, unfortunately, very often they just bring them too late to me, so I can't save them. But just the same, he was known as a healer in the region. Who built the church? The first church in the Yukon at a place today called Russian Mission, which Father Nitsvetov called by its Yupik name, Ikogmi. Four skilled carpenters and craftsmen in wood from St. Paul. Plus their foreman, Nikolai Belkov, came to Ikogmut and built the first church there. After the church was built, they returned home, except Nikolai Belkov, who decided to remain in the Yukon. His three sons stayed there, and Zakhary Belkov, born on St. Paul, raised on St. Paul, educated by Yakov Nitsvetov, is remembered as the Yupik priest who kept Orthodoxy alive after 1867 and the Yukon Kuskokwim area, almost single-handedly. He was joined, incidentally, in capacity of a reader in 1868 by Amlia chief Fyodor Dedyukhin. In effect, what happened after 1867, they were immigrants from the Aleut area moving into the Kuskokwim Yukon region and clustering around the church that was established there by a bunch of Aleuts. Nitsvetov, his deacon, was Innokenty Shayashnikov, and in this town, I don't think I have to explain who he is, or do I? No. In 1848, he was consecrated priest by St. Innocent of the Aleutians at St. Michael and traveled with St. Innocent from St. Michael to Unalaska to assume the office of a parish priest here in his native Unalaska. He was the eldest son of Kasyan Shayashnikov, the manager of the Pribilof Armies. He is remembered very well in memoirs by many Americans who came to Unalaska, the officers of the Revenue Cutter Service, their wives, and so on. His daughters were accomplished young ladies. He was a well-educated man. His discourse was much appreciated. He entertained William Dahl when he was here, and so on. He was also robbed blind by Sheldon Jackson. His library is in Sheldon Jackson College. It's the core, the best rare books in Sheldon Jackson College library bear an inscription from the library of Innokenty Shayashnikov. You didn't know that? Yeah. He had a marvelous library here. And then, of course, the most famous of the native sons who became an admiral of the Russian Navy. In 1784, a young Russian boy, aged 13, came to Kodiak. He grew up here. He became a navigator, then a manager for Baranov on Kodiak. He married locally, and he had 11 children. The name is Kashevarov. His eldest son explored the polar shore of Alaska. His other sons were navigators, managers. One of them was a manager of Kodiak District of the Russian American Company. Another one became a manager in St. Michael and so on. There are lots of Kashevarovs, I don't need to tell you. They're still with us. Yakov Nitsvetov had two younger brothers, Joseph and Anton. Anton became a most respected skipper for the Russian American Company. They sent him every year, they sent him to beyond the Bering Strait, to Kotzebue Sound, to trade with the Eskimos there. And he carried out various commissions for the governor. And after he has served with the company for 10 years, he retired, went to Russia, entered the Navy, and became a Russian Navy officer and a gentleman. Joseph died at Sitka. Joseph went to St. Petersburg, was trained as a shipbuilder, and he became the chief of the shipbuilding establishment at Sitka. He retired in his, well in his 60s, on a pension, and he died in Sitka and is buried there. So as you, what was happening here, through the education that was established, the Russians were creating a whole social class of people who were Russian by education, but by origin, by their emotional attachments, they were natives. This education was interesting in one thing. It was bilingual and bicultural. From the beginning, instruction was in Russian, yes, but also in the native languages of the people. In the chain, in Aleut, at Kodiak, in Sukhpya, at Sitka, in Tlingit, at Kalmakovsky Redoubt, at Ikogmut, and Nushagak, in Yupik. When Nitsvetov moved to the Yukon in 1845, he already had translations of instructional books and church books into Yupik by 1848, in 3 years. Now we're celebrating the anniversary of establishment of Vinyaminov's school here in Unalaska in 1825. This school too, from its inception, was bilingual. And it was open to all. Children of the Russians who lived here, they were in minority, they were very few. And the Aleuts who lived here. And on the school rolls, we find names as Emelyan Birukov, Ilarion Archimandritov. There are several Burenians, and so on. Those people later on, if we go through the records of Russian American Company, are scattered all over Alaska in responsible positions. They're running the show. Excuse me. They were cartographers. Lavrenty Solomatov became a priest in Atka in 1844 when Nitsvetov went to the Yukon. He was born in Atka, educated by Nitsvetov in Atka. He left us marvelous literary works in Atka and Aleut. His brother David was a cartographer. He mapped the entire western end of the chain. Again, in the Chebenkov Atlas, you will see on the map, mapped by David Solomatov. Leschenkovs. Today there are Leschenkovs in St. Paul and St. George. They're mostly priests, hereditary priests. The first Inokentiy Leschenkov to become priest grew up on Atka and was educated by Yakov Nitsvetov. The list is rather large. But what interests me more is that the idea of school and education found a great acceptance by the Aleut people themselves. In remote villages, Aleut chiefs established schools and ran them themselves. On Amlia, Chief Nikolai Didyukhin established a school looking at the model on Atka. And his son, Fyodor Didyukhin, conducted this school in 1867. Then he left. They, perhaps those, when we say school, we exaggerate a little bit. It was a house school. There was no special building, but children were taught, and they were taught well. Very many people accepted literacy. And for me as an anthropologist, it is interesting because, for example, Tlingit in Sitka never, to this day, well, I shouldn't say to this day, but to up to 1867, even though Tlingit script was devised and books in Tlingit were being printed by the in the Russian Empire, Tlingits never took to the written expression. The Aleuts took to it like ducks to water. By 1830, an Aleut by the name of Kurvata from Bilkovsky wrote a novel in Aleut. Unfortunately, the manuscript of that novel disappeared. All we know is that Father Vinyaminov, in his book on the essay, on an experiment on the essay, an experiment on Aleut grammar, mentions that this man, so-and-so, wrote a novel. I don't think that anybody remains alive who can tell me if the Aleut people had a tradition of lost literacy. But I have always wondered why, of all the people of Alaska, the Aleuts were the people who took to formal education and to literacy, to reading and writing in their own language. By the end of Father Vinyaminov's sojourn here in 1834, he says that all the men who lived in the Pribilofs could read and write. We know that Chief Ivan Pankov from Tigalda and Akuny Islands and his son Simeon assisted Vinyaminov in creating Aleut script and creating the first written books in Aleut language. We know that Vinyaminov, when he made translations of the Bible, asked Aleut people who could speak Russian to read his translations to the congregation on Umnak and here in Alaska, and he asked for criticism so that he could correct what he has written. He asked the Aleut people, say, does that make sense in your own language? Am I correct? He did, and this is how he worked with the people from the very beginning. They trained artists. In Sitka, in the villages, they were the beginning school, say elementary level. In Sitka, we had something like college level. And many artists were trained there. Another Serebrennikov, I think he was a brother to Ruf, who got killed on the Copper River, was sent as an ethnographic artist to the North Slope aboard the ship. I don't know if his ethnographic sketches of the Eskimos up on the North Slope survive. This is, somebody has to go to the Soviet Union, break into the Navy archive, and see if we can find those pictures. Pardon? Yeah. We know that in this community, in this church, there are items that were painted by an Aleut, Vasily Krukov. They are in the chapel of St. Sergius of Radonezh on the royal door, and they are on the iconostasy in this chapel of St. Innocent. The question is, who trained those people? I really think, for example, that with Krukov, it was a combination of Veniaminov's encouragement and the Aleut tradition of the art of painting. And you would want to ask me, I suppose, how is it that without cloth, without brushes, Aleuts could paint? Well, they used wood, and they used mineral pigments here. And they created incredible works of art of painting by decorating the wooden hunting hats of their men. And tomorrow we're going to see some of this. I don't know what more I can say, something for Father Michael on this question. All I can say is that during the Russian period, a lot of Aleut people, if they wanted to, could go to school and they could assume a position of authority. But Galaktionov family, was the medical officer for Atka district. There was at the time of the American takeover, there was a native head of the hospital in Sitka. So they were artists, medical officers, priests, captains of ships, cartographers, navigators, managers. Not everybody, of course, but a substantial number. This was the group of people who suffered most greatly after 1867, because from a position of authority and respect, they were demoted. And nothing is as hard to take as social declassification. It took us a long time to come back to the idea that bilingual education has a value, that bilingual and bicultural education is necessary to preserve people's self-respect, feeling of self-worth. I hope that we have come to accept this idea and that, well, not a new day, but maybe a new day, in terms of what education is all about. And I am also going to talk to you about Aleut art. To me, art is sort of the greatest symbol, an icon of a people's culture. And Aleuts had wonderful art. I get sick and tired reading in the books that the Russians came, destroyed Aleut culture, and there's no Aleut art. I know better. And today, I'm going to show you some slides. I'll start with some historical slides, and I'll then, including portraits of people who lived in the early 1800s and who have names. They're real people. We know who they are or where they live. When a Russian Navy painter painted somebody's portrait, he didn't say, like Weber did, Native woman of Unalaska. He said, so-and-so of such and such a village. So I would like to show you those portraits. And then I'm going to show you just one aspect of Aleut art, the marvelous ivory carvings from the island of Atka. Interspersed with them will be a few slides of ivory carvings from different areas of the chain, just to show you that the art of the Aleut people was not uniform, that each region had its own style. And I know that Aleut Art never died, and it's still alive. Maybe not too terribly well, but it's getting better. Yeah. And, okay?
Sure.
I'm going to cut this class short because my voice is giving out and Ray wants me to talk tomorrow. I didn't know him.
All right, we can have a mic up close to you. We'll secure you as well.
Excuse me, can we have a last back on just for a moment?
Sure.
Oh,